Thursday the 14th of June, Rabbi Mordechai Becher, Stem Cell Research.
Apropos of what was just said, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was once told that someone had said one of his Divrei Torah over, one of his Chidushim, and didn't quote it from Reb Chaim. And so Reb Chaim said, that doesn't bother me so much. If he says my Chidush in his name, that's fine. Problem is, if he says his Chidushim in my name, that bothers me. In any case, apropos also of what was said, most of this class is based on the writings of Rav Yitzhak Dreidowitz and Dr. Daniel Eisenberg, who have done a lot of investigation into the issue of stem cell research. We've only got half an hour, and it's quite a broad topic. Let me start, first of all, with just a very, very brief idea of what we mean by stem cell research. First of all, we know that the fertilized egg has total potential, totipotent is what they call it, meaning it can develop into the entire human being, into every single component of the human being. So the totipotent cells form a hollow sphere called a blastocyst. The blastocyst has an outer layer of cells, an inside layer of cluster cells called the inner cell mass. Now, the inner cell mass is pluripotent, meaning it cannot give rise to everything, but it can give rise to many cells, or most of the types of cells necessary for fetal development. So the pluripotent stem cells, then, they further specialise. And therefore, they will specialise into cells that have particular functions. So the more specialised stem cells are called multipotent. So what you have is a process of specialisation, starting off with maximum potential, which is the fertilised egg, right, and then you have lesser potential, not much less, and the blastocyst, the inner cell mass, etc., which can go into become virtually any part of the body, and then you finally have the specialized cells. Now, the pluripotent stem cells are generally isolated directly from the inner cell mass at the stage of the where it's pre-embryonic, meaning in the first few days, usually the first 4 days of the fertilization of the egg. The embryos are taken from IVF in vitro fertilization clinics. In vitro fertilization clinics tend to fertilize many eggs from, let's say, the same woman, many eggs from the same woman, but they will not implant all of them for obvious reasons, right? So therefore, there will be many leftover fertilized eggs. The estimate is in the United States, there are approximately 100,000 about 100,000 fertilized eggs, pre-embryos, in the freezer with the Häagen-Dazs. So, or whatever, right? So, in any case, but they're there, right? And the other place you can derive stem cells from fetal tissue as well, from, let's say, from an aborted fetus, for example, or they can be obtained from umbilical cords. Now, what are the potential applications here? What's the big deal? Well, the big deal is a few things. First of all, if we understand the events of human development, we are better able to cure problems that arise during that development. Secondly, we can identify the factors that cause what we call, I suppose, the decision-making process of the cell. What I mean by decision-making is the cell doesn't say, I think I'll be a liver. No, maybe a kidney. Well, you know, it's not like that. But there is some process by which the cells specialize and receive their marching orders to develop into particular parts of the human body. Obviously, also, it will be possible to test new medications on human cell lines, generation of cells and tissues for cell therapy, and obviously, I think probably the greatest hope is that we will be able to use this to cure things like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, spinal cord injury, stroke, burned heart, because you don't have any of the problems of rejection of a foreign body, foreign organ in the body, etc., etc. You can, if you could develop, actually grow an organ, so to speak, or parts of an organ for a person using stem cells, which will grow into that totally untainted, totally without disease, etc., then it has vast, tremendous potential. Now, clearly, it's possible to get stem cells from an adult stem cell. Problem with that is, first of all, they're only present in minute quantities. Secondly, for certain disorders which are acute and which time is pressing, there's just not necessarily enough time to grow it from his own adult stem cell. In addition, the adult stem cells may have more DNA abnormalities caused by exposure to daily living. I mean, sunlight, toxins, sunlight is right. Okay, right. I'm just straight. Okay, it's just England, toxins, and unexpected errors in DNA replication. So those are some of the issues. There has been some progress recently. It's got an article, this is in New Scientist, just the 9th of June 2007. There have been some breakthroughs, but of course it's a long way from actual breakthroughs, breakthroughs in getting stem cells, reprogramming adult mouse stem cells, right, and making them into cells that are virtually indistinguishable from embryonic stem cells. That is a fantastic thing, because if you could get it from adults, then you'd have none of the ethical problems associated with getting stem cells from either embryos, pre-embryos, or fetal tissue. So, halakhically, there are really, I think, six questions that have to be dealt with regarding stem cell research. The first is there a general problem of, to put in quotation marks, playing God regarding stem cell research? Number two is, in order to get these fertilized eggs, pre-embryos, etc., you obviously have to involve yourself in in vitro fertilization. Is that permitted? Number three, if you are obtaining the stem cells from the pre-embryo or the embryo or from a fetus, then you have to determine whether, under what circumstances, it is permitted, if at all, to destroy this fetus, this pre-embryo or this embryo. In other words, this is obviously regarding what the attitude is to abortion. Number four, is a pre-embryo included in the prohibition of abortion? At what stage does the cell, does the fertilized egg take on the status of a fetus, etc.? What is the status of a fetus? We'll see that is questionable. And number five, let's say it is a fetus, it is alive, etc., but under what circumstances can a very early pre-embryo be sacrificed if you could save a life, either right here and now, or you could save lives in future for the purpose of the research here? And finally, number six, is there some obligation for us or for Rabbonim to make some type of Gedorim, make offences, etc., even though we don't have the authority to do that today, but maybe, at least on the authority that the Rav has, that people will listen to certain Rabbonim, maybe there is some obligation. So let's start with number one. What is the human obligation regarding so-called playing God? Of course, the Rambam deals with this in his Pirush HaMishnayos in Sochem, where he deals with the issue of someone who maintained that, and this is actually was one of his great debates with the Karaites that the Rambam was involved in fighting through a lot of his life. The Karaites maintained that it was wrong to involve yourself in any medical intervention, because they said, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides that a person is sick, who are you to intervene? It is wrong for a person to intervene. The Rambam, of course, cites the idea that you don't even need the pasuk of Verapo Yerape, Mikan Shenitla Rishus the Roifel Arapoi, you shall heal, from here has been given permission. He says that does not need to be said, just to tell you that. Why? He says, because what's the logic of non-intervening? The logic of non-intervening is the person says the following. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu made this person sick, then whatever he does, right, if he decides that he will not be healed, going to the doctor won't help. And if Hashem wants him to be healed, he doesn't need to go to the doctor. So the Rambam says, let me ask you a question. Let's say Hashem decided this person should die of starvation. So will eating help? He says, and if Hashem said he will not die of starvation, he says he doesn't need to eat. So therefore, if you eat, is this not an issue? So the guy says, oh, it's a good point. Right, but the Rambam is saying is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's decrees are not necessarily either or. Meaning, they are not, if that this guy will die no matter what he does, or he'll live no matter what he does. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's decrees are al-tnai, that is to say, conditional upon what we do. In other words, he built into the system human responsibility so that, yes, Hashem says, if the idiot doesn't eat, of course he'll die of starvation, right? There's a tnai built into it. So that's number one. Number two, I should point out that the Torah tells us that pruvu milu asaret v'chiv shuha, right? Which is, pruvu is to have children, but what does it mean, and fill the earth, v'chiv shuha, and conquer it? Now, this is understood by the Maharal in the Be'er HaGola and others as meaning a general idea that is actually within the role of the human being to conquer nature and to correct errors, so to speak, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as the Be'er HaGoyla says, this is, he says, did not create the perfect world. He created the world that needs to be perfected. Just as we know, morally and spiritually, he didn't create us perfect, right? But he created us with a need to be perfected, and he gave us the Bechira, which is a tremendous power in order to do that. So also, in the physical realm, it is also true that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the human being the power to improve the world. The Maharal says, in Be'er HaGoyla, he says, as you know, Be'er HaGoyla was written as a response to questions. He was given a list of questions by Christian scholars in Prague, kashas on the Torah, mainly the Torah Shebaal Peh and the Rabbanon, and he wrote this Sefer as a response to many of these questions. Evidently, one of the things that bothered them was the idea of the interbreeding of species. They felt this was witchcraft or some very negative power. The Maharal says, look, the Torah prohibits mixing of species. Ein hachinami, it is true the Torah prohibits mixing of species, but it's not something which we should be shocked by that such a thing is possible. He says, because the power of the human is greater than the power of nature, because the Kodesh Baruch Hu endowed us with the Tzelem Elohim, which is that power to be a Boireh. Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz, I'm not sure how the titles go, I'm Australian, so we're not into that. But anyway, Rabbi Jacobovitz wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal in 1997. I'll just quote what he said. He says, we can dismiss, this is regarding cloning, we can dismiss the common argument of playing God or interfering with divine providence in reference to cloning. Every medical intervention represents such interference. In the Jewish tradition, this is expressly sanctioned in the biblical words, and he shall cause his victim to be healed, v'rapa yirapa. The Talmud says, from here we see the physician is given permission to heal. Such interference, he says, therefore, is not really an issue, because virtually any medical, invasive procedure, etc., is always interference anyway, and that is certainly permitted. Not only permitted, but as the Ramban says, reshus l'roifel l'rapois, reshus the mitzvah, right? It is a mitzvah to actually intervene. And he says, however, he does add one caveat, which is that it's permitted only for therapy, not for eugenics. Meaning, we will be permitted to cure diseases, but not because I want a child, you know, I look at the shidduch profiles, which is the most highly probable to get a shidduch, and I ask the geneticist to design the kid so that he'll fit into the profile. Right? So, it's not a bad idea, actually. But anyway, but he says that would be prohibited, that's called eugenics. That would not be something which is allowed. It is okay for refuah. There is, by the way, just parenthetically, an interesting machloikus regarding cosmetic surgery. That is to say, surgery to change appearance, etc., which in which there seems to be an argument between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Eliezer Yehuda Voldenberg, Tzitz Eliezer. Rav Moshe Feinstein was of the lenient opinion, which he said that that a person may do so. He felt that it came under the aegis of Verapa Yerape. However, Tzitz Eliezer was very much against it. He felt that change of appearance was something which was not included in refuah. He did agree, of course, if the person had been Chasoshon disfigured in a fire accident or something like that, then certainly the reverting to his original appearance would be, of course, considered refuah. But he says other improvements he was seen to be against it. Whether or not he would extend this to the ideas of stem cell research, I don't think so, because stem cell research is clearly not for the improvement of appearance, but rather for the eradication of and cure of various diseases, so it would probably, even according to Sicilieta, come under Rapa Yerapa. That was our first question. The second question of IVF in Halacha, the truth is this has been dealt with for many, many years, and although many poskim say that there's no chiyuv, no obligation for a couple who cannot have children through normal methods, doesn't appear to be a chiyuv to go beyond, because in generally in halacha, the chiyuv is to do that which is under normal human capabilities. Lo nitna Torah l'malachei asharis, the Torah was not given to angels, and therefore within what human capabilities are in a natural way, we are mechuyev. But nevertheless, a significant majority of poskim do allow in vitro fertilization. Obviously, there are going to be certain conditions. For example, the sperm should come from any donor, but should come from the husband. Interesting view that the Igus Moshe has regarding this, that he says if the sperm does come from someone who is not the husband, nevertheless the child is not a mamzer. Very interesting. In other words, if there be in vitro fertilization, the sperm not coming from the husband of this woman, nevertheless that child is 100% kosher. And his logic is, and this was hotly disputed by a number of poskim, but he said that his logic was that mamzerus is not based on genetics. It is not based on the physical science of it. It is based on whether there was a bias isur. If there was a prohibited relationship, bias isur, somewhat two people transgress the avera, either adultery or incest, that creates the mamzer. If there was no bias isur, there is no mamzer. And it's very interesting because he was looking at it totally from the point of view of pure Torah. In other words, he says, you are bringing in ideas from genetics, etc., into mamzerus, which who says? How do you know that such a thing has any implication? All we know from the Torah, from the Gemara, is bias isur creates mamzer. There was no bias isur in this case, IVF, therefore there's no mamzerus. Again, as I said, it was a matter of dispute, but it appears that his view is accepted. But nevertheless, even he agrees, l'chatchila, that it should always be from the husband. And that seems to be something which is accepted by virtually all poskim, that IVF procedures are, while not necessarily obligatory, because they involve tremendous psychological stress, very often physical stress, and certainly great, great financial burden. And so not a chiyuv, but nevertheless certainly a tremendous thing if a couple is courageous enough to do that, to want to have children through that method. Now we come to the pre-embryo. I'm a little out of order here. I want to get to the pre-embryo first just to define what that is. So the pre-embryo is used to describe the cell development from the time the egg is fertilized until it's implanted into the uterine wall. Implantation is usually within 10 to 14 days of fertilization. At about 10 to 14 days, a dark streak appears in the cells. That dark streak will eventually form the neural tube, which eventually, of course, will be the spinal cord, etc. And the appearance of this streak, coupled with uterine implantation, is what they usually define as the transition from pre-embryonic to embryonic stage. The next stage, the embryonic stage, is around 8 weeks, or about 40 days, whatever, in which there is a rudimentary development of the differentiated organs. At that point, it's no longer looked at as an embryo, it's now looked at as a fetus. Now, so regarding abortion and its the fetus. So, first of all, we know there seems to be contradictory sukkim, makoros, regarding abortion. Of course, there is the pasuk in Bereishis 9, where the pasuk says, "Shofech dam ha'adam be'adam damo yishafech." The one who sheds the blood of a man within a man, his blood shall be shed. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Rabbi Shmuel says, "What is a man within a man? Ezu adam be'adam." That refers to a fetus in the womb of the mother, and according to that, it would appear to be a capital crime of murder to actually kill the fetus. Problem with that in Parshas Mishpatim. In Shmoyt Chaf Aleph, we have the case of two men who are fighting, right? V'nafu ishahara, v'yatsu yaladeha, her child is, yatsu yaladeha, by the way, doesn't mean she gives birth, it means that she miscarries. Yatsu yaladeha is not used for birth. This, by the way, is the famous mistake in the Latin Vulgate translation of the Torah, which is where Christian view comes from. They translate yatsu yaladeha as she gives birth. And then they say, if so she gives birth, that means there's no harm. And therefore, but it says, if there is any harm, im ason yihyeh, which the pasuk says after, nefesh tachas nefesh, they say that in Mishpatim, that refers to actually the nefesh tachas nefesh refers to the killing of the fetus of the woman. Of course, it's a mistranslation of the yatsi aladeh, which actually means miscarriage. But in the case of miscarriage, according to the correct translation, miscarriage means what happens at this point. It says, he shall be sued. In other words, he pays financial compensation, which therefore does not sound at all like what it says in Bereishis, which is the idea of actual murder of Ratzicha. So there are a few resolutions to this. One is that in Bereishis we are talking about for a Ben Noach, that indeed we have a situation here which is unusual, but does happen sometimes, which is that the law for a Ben Noach is more chamor than that for a Jew. That for a Ben Noach, for a Gentile, to actually abort a fetus would be considered murder, whereas for a Jew, it's considered not murder, but according to the Pasuk in Mishpatim, it would be considered chavola, which is wounding. The prohibition of wounding the mother by killing the fetus. That would be one way. The Rambam in Mishneh Torah and Hilchos Rotzeh for Shmuras and Nefesh, the Rambam says very differently. The Rambam understands that that indeed killing a fetus is considered to be Ratzicha. However, he says it's a Ratzicha which is not punishable in the Bidei Odom. It's not punishable in the human court. In the human court, it would only be Chavola. That means, in the eyes of heaven, in Bidei Shamayim, Dinei Shamayim, he's a Rotzeach. That's the Rambam says. Dinei Shamayim is a Rotzeach. Dinei Odom, right, we cannot judge him as a Rotzeach. We have to only judge in terms of the financial compensation of Chavola, of torts and damages, etc. So that would be the most Chamor view. So we have now two views, therefore, of abortion. We have the Rambam, who would hold that it's actual Ratzicha, even though not punishable by their courts. And we have views of others who maintain that it's Chavola, that it is wounding the mother. And we have actually those who also hold to Tosfos, who holds that it's actually not even wounding. The prohibition of abortion would be Hashchosa Zera, which is the destruction, wanton destruction of seed, wanton destruction of sperm, and would certainly, I guess, even Karl Weimer apply if the sperm is just a potential, but to the actual life that develops from it, right, in terms of the fetus, it would be considered Hashchosas Zera. The Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, interestingly, in his Kiddushim on the Rambam, in Hilchos Rotzeach, the way he understands it, he says, is that the fetus is indeed a full-fledged human being, but not quite. Meaning, he says that normally, in the case of fetus, if the mother's life is in danger, we know that the Mishnah tells us in Oholos that you have to kill the fetus to save the life of the mother. Now here, Rav Chaim points out, it's a strange case of roidef. Here it's a roidef, a pursuer. The fetus is looked at as pursuing the mother to kill the mother. But here it's a different case, because normally the roidef makes a decision, an evil decision, to kill someone. Here, this is Mishmaya Karad Fula. She is being pursued by heaven, as the Gemara says, right? The Gemara says, Sahedra, she's being pursued by heaven. But he says, if so, why is the being pursued by heaven, meaning the fetus is totally innocent, why is it that that's only applied when the fetus's head actually comes out of the birth canal? Why, when the fetus is inside, in the uterus, are we allowed to kill the fetus to save the mother? Haray ein doichin nefesh bifnei nefesh. Generally, we have a rule that you don't push one soul away in front of another. And so, therefore, if someone falls off some building, whatever, and he is about to crush the person underneath and kill him, and I, with my laser or whatever, can disintegrate the person falling, I wouldn't be allowed to do that. Because the person falling is not a deliberate roideth. He's not deliberately pursuing. He's what's called Mishmaya Karatlai here, quite literally. From heaven he's being pursued. Right? So therefore, normally we'd say, right, Ein doichin nefesh bifnei nefesh. You cannot push one away in front of the other. So why can you do it in the case of the mother and the fetus? Answer is, even though the fetus is a nefesh regarding the laws of saving life, pikuach nefesh, right, however, it's compared to the mother, it's not a nefesh. Meaning, it is a nefesh, but not quite. In other words, compared to the mother, how the Reb Chaim puts it, right, it's a distinction which is very important. So he says, it is still considered an nefesh, i.e., because according to the Rambam, it's Ratzeach, but it's not quite an nefesh compared to the life of the mother. So now, we now have a few ideas. First of all, there is a view, by the way, that it's actually Drabonon. I mean, there's a minority view that abortion is actually Drabonon, and the Tzitzit Eliezer quotes that he's quite lenient about abortion in certain situations, certainly before the first 40 days. Now, if the prohibition is murder, that would give us the least leeway in terms of using the embryo or the fetus. If the prohibition is destruction of seed, is Hashkosa Zera or Chavala, that clearly gives the most leeway, because we know that Lahalacha, first of all, Poskim have Paskim, that Hashkosa Zera, for the purposes of medical diagnosis, etc., is actually permitted, because Hashkosa means wanton destruction. I don't mean burning down Chinese restaurants, right, but wanton with an A, wanton destruction, meaning without any purpose. If the purpose, though, is a positive purpose, halakhically valid purpose, that would be permitted. Also, Chavala. Chavala is really there is a certain subjectivity to what Chavala is, right? Meaning, very often a surgeon's doing Chavala, isn't he? The answer is, it's not derech nitza umariva, it's not destructive and violent, it is rather constructive and positive. So if the prohibition against abortion, which appears to be a very large view in the Rishonim, is Chavala or Hashchata Zera, that would certainly give us a lot of leeway in terms of using it for potential medical benefits. Also, if the prohibition is Chavala, it would appear to be that the Chavala refers to Chavala of the mother, which means if the fetus is not in uterus, if the fetus is not in the mother, then there appears to be no issue whatsoever. In other words, the fetus is in the freezer, right? It's not inside the uterus. Then chavala doesn't apply here because the chavala is on the mother, not on the fetus, and consequently that would also give the most leeway. Also, even if the prohibition also is hashchata zera, so in the case of a frozen embryo where there's very minimum chance of life, in other words, here, hashchata zera is the destruction of life potential here. When you've got a frozen embryo, right, which is not likely to be implanted in anyone, and even if it is, it's very unlikely because the possibility of it actually coming to fruition, the longer it is kept frozen state, the lower the probability of it ever turning into life. Therefore, there'd be very wide leeway if you hold. So the truth is, according to most Rishonim, it would appear either it's Chavala or Hashchata Zera or the minority Issur Rabbanan. According to them, there would appear to be much less of a problem in using these for scientific research. What about the 440 days? Well, first of all, the Gemara in Yevamos, because these, by the way, the stem cells are always taken in the pre-embryonic stage, almost always, which is way before 40 days. It's in the first 4 to 14 days of life, or if you want to call it life, right? So consequently, the Gemara in Yevamos says that Maya Ba'alma, before 40 days, the fetus is considered just a liquid, i.e., there is it doesn't it's not the halachas of a miscarriage wouldn't apply if that fetus is or the pre-embryo is expelled before that time. And many contemporary authorities, for instance, Rav Yosef Sholem Eliashiv and Rav David Feinstein, were asked the following question: a couple who wished to avoid having children with Tay Sachs. Evidently, they got married, they didn't have the test, whatever, and so, or whether the woman has a disease which is linked to a specific gender, like Fragile X. There was even a case where she had a skin lesion disease, neurofibromatosis, right? So the case there, the diagnosis was, suggestion was, that when they have the child, what they would do is they would have in vitro fertilization, right? Then they'd test which one of the various embryos did not have the disease, and then implant the embryo that did not have the disease. In other words, not every embryo will necessarily have the genetic disease. Okay, so without going to the details of that, so they would, what they do is they do IVF, in vitro fertilization, with the husband's sperm, wife's egg, right? They determine, they test which one of the embryos did not have the disease. Then they implant that one. What would they do with the others? Automatically, that means they'd be destroying the others. And Rav Eliashiv and Rav David Feinstein both committed it in that case. And they committed it not only in the case where it was a dangerous illness like Tay Sachs or Fragile X, but even in the case of a woman with a disease that would have, a genetic illness that would have given the child skin lesions, they still allowed such a diagnosis. That would seem to me to be a very strong argument based on Rav Eliashiv and Rav David Feinstein to permit the killing of the pre-embryo, even the fertilized pre-embryos, in order for stem cell research, etc. They apparently did not consider them to be fetuses yet, or they did not consider it to be chavala yet because it was not in the mother's womb, or they maybe did not consider hashchata zera because of the lack of probability of it developing into a life, all of those reasons. That would be number five. We now come to the... so we have, if excess zygotes can be discarded, so it appears clear they can be used for research, and if the pre-implantation diagnosis and IVF are allowed, then the excess certainly, I mean, if Rabbi Yosef says you can destroy those excess ones, would you be allowed to use them for research? I would say, of course. Now, if Rabbi Yosef is saying you can destroy them, then using them for research appears to be a kal vachomer a fortiori that it should be okay. Finally, we come to, are we obligated to make a fence? So first of all, I should point out, we don't have a Sanhedrin, which means no one can really make a gezeirah today. It would be a matter, if a Gadol Yisrael decides something is inappropriate, then if the community accepts that, they accept that, and that's wonderful, but there's no power or authority to make a gezeirah al kol Klal Yisrael. Nevertheless, there are sometimes, we know, that Rabbanim do make gedorim, right? And do and people do accept them, and should they do so here? So it's interesting. Here, there's not much talk about that, except I found from Rav Moshe David Tendler, Rav Moshe Feinstein's son-in-law, who is actually head of he's on the National Bioethics Advisory Council of the President, President Bush, and he's also head of medical school at Albert Einstein, which is the Yeshiva University Medical School. So he says, if the fence is designed for the tikkun ha'olam, for the prevention of problems, he says, but here, right, since according to most poskim, it appears to be something which is permitted, and erecting a fence so that it will not be abused will actually have the effect of preventing cures for diseases and potential benefits to society. He says it appears to him, at least, that it would be something which you should not. We should not be involved in making any gedorim, and we should come out in favor of it. Actually, it's interesting because the OU, Union of Orthodox Congregations of the United States, I'll just end with this, wrote a letter to George Bush in which they say four main points. Our Torah tradition places great value on human life. The potential to save and heal human beings is an integral part of valuing life. Rabbinic authorities inform us that an isolated, fertilized egg does not enjoy the full status of personhood and its attendant protections, and thus, in their conclusion, they write, if embryonic stem cell research can help us preserve and heal humans with greater success and does not require or encourage the destruction of life in the process, it ought to be pursued, which was the opinion, at least, of the Orthodox Union in the United States. Unfortunately, or I would say, American policy has been influenced greatly by fundamentalist Christian ideology, which is actually, as we know, radically different, and usually Orthodox Jews are bundled together with the fundamentalist Christians in terms of, oh yeah, they're all religious, don't say that, you know, that type of thing, which is, as we know, is ludicrous, right? But nevertheless, that's the case, and I think it's important that we should understand that, at least from the halakhic perspective, there is quite it appears at least major leeway and possibility of stem cell research being permitted, not mainly permitted, but actually a good thing to do. Okay, thank you. All right. All right. All right. Okay.